Good evening and welcome to Behind the News for March 29, 2007. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. I'm out of town, so I'm coming to you on recording. You can tell by the fact that I've excised all the wretched ums. An econ-heavy show tonight. First, in about 5 minutes, we'll hear from Mark Levitan, the senior policy analyst of the Community Service Society, about the job market in New York City in 2006. Some good news at the headline level, less good news when you drill down below the surface. And then at the bottom of the hour, we'll hear from longtime housing market Cassandra Dean Baker of the Center for Economic and Policy Research in D.C. And just because I'm calling him Cassandra doesn't mean he wasn't right. He's been right all along. Before all that, some words on the week's economic news. Once again, a lot of it was about housing. On Wednesday, Federal Reserve Chair Ben Bernanke testified before Congress. He said that the bursting of the housing bubble, though of course he'd never used such lively language, has been the major cause of a slowdown in the U.S. economy in recent months. Though he didn't say it, it's likely that Bernanke and his colleagues at the Fed welcome this development, since a slower economy generally means less inflationary pressure. It could also mean an upward drift in the unemployment rate and downward pressure on wages, which they'd also welcome, though of course he didn't put the matter quite that clearly. But Bernanke seems sanguine about the problems in the so-called subprime mortgage sector that have troubled financial markets over the last few weeks. Though we'll hear more about this from Dean Baker in the second half of the show, the subprime sector is the one that's populated by poorer borrowers, or those with spotty credit histories, an area of the mortgage market that has boomed in recent years. Some of our more pessimistic pundits have expressed worries that problems in this sector could spread beyond into more prime sectors, which could happen if lenders got nervous and sharply cut back on new loans, even to the more creditworthy. Bernanke sounded like he was not among the pessimists. Here's what he said. Although the turmoil in the subprime mortgage market has created severe problems for many individuals and families, the implications of these developments for the housing market as a whole are less clear. The ongoing tightening of lending standards, although an appropriate market response, will reduce somewhat the effective demand for housing, and foreclosed properties will add to the inventories of unsold homes. At this juncture, however, the impact in the broader economy and financial markets of the problems in the subprime market seems rather likely to be contained. In particular, mortgages to prime borrowers and fixed-rate mortgages to all classes of borrowers continue to perform well, with low rates of delinquency. We will continue to monitor this situation closely. And that's the end of Bernanke's quote. He was supported in this view on the same day by Treasury Secretary Henry Hank Paulson, whose last job, it should be pointed out, was as chair of Goldman Sachs, the giant and prestige-laden investment bank that was deeply involved in peddling and investing in the very mortgage-related securities that are now the objects of worry. Bernanke did share another worry with Congress, however, the slowdown in business spending on plant and equipment. Such investment is an important driver of economic growth over the long term, and the recent numbers in this area have made for depressing reading. For the 6 months ending in February, business capital spending is off at a 13% annualized rate. Its long-term average growth rate is around plus 7%, so they're underperforming their average by about 20 percentage points, a big gap. This sector has lagged badly throughout this weird expansion that began at the end of 2001. Corporate profits have been very high, which means that corporations have both the incentive to invest and the money to do it as well. Instead, they prefer to spend their gusher of cash on taking over each other and buying back their own stock to boost its price. That's been very good for the stock market, but has not been so good for the broader economy. But after bringing up this worry, Bernanke essentially dismissed it, saying things will get better later in the year. That does seem to be the Fed's view these days. The slowdown in economic growth is just a bump in the road, and after that, it's back to the races. As I pointed out here many times, this expansion has been the most lopsided in modern history, with business and the rich hogging all the gains, and the rest of us lucky to stay in place. If the economy doesn't recover in the way Bernanke hopes it will, and it's all hope so far since they're not likely to cut interest rates anytime soon, then merely staying in place will come to look pretty good. Okay, let's take a musical break, and we'll be back with Mark Levitan. and that was Killing Joke, an excerpt from their 1990s song, Money Is Not Our God. I'm afraid money has a near-divine status around many of these parts, though. The New York City economy is a funny thing. Lots of financiers and luxury housing, lots of poor people, and, well, what else? I heard social stats guru Andrew Beveridge of Queens College on another radio station the other day saying that the income distribution in Manhattan is now the most unequal of any county in the U.S. Manhattan used to be beat by a small county in Hawaii that is the former site of a leper colony, but no longer. According to Beveridge, the lopsidedness of income distribution in this splendid island now rivals Namibia for its inequality. So what about broader labor market trends? For that, we turn to Mark Levitan of the Community Service Society. Levitan is the author of many useful reports on the human dimension of the New York City economy. His latest is on the city's job market in 2006, which you can download from the Community Service Society's website at cssny.org. That's cssny.org. Okay, Mark Levitan. Welcome, Mark Levitan. On the surface, let's start with the good news. On the surface, we had a good year in the job market in New York City last year. What are the details on the unemployment rate?
Well, the unemployment rate for New York City in 2006 was 4.9%. That's an all-time low. You'd have to go back to 1988 before you saw a year with an unemployment rate that compared at all to something like that.
And what's been driving the decline in unemployment?
Well, the fundamental thing is that we're in a period of recovery. Since 2003, we've regained most of the jobs we've lost in the recession. Employment levels are going up and unemployment is going down. So we're on the upswing of a business cycle.
And any particular sector leading the way?
Well, I think that if you looked at what's leading the way in the last 3 years, it's been lower-wage industries, things like the hospitality sector. Hospitals is always a big employer and growing employment there. Some of the higher-wage industries are finally beginning to pick up employment, but they've generally been lagging the lower-wage industries.
Well, the highest-wage industry of all has been having a very good time of it, finance. Are they spreading around any of the good cheer at all?
Well, to some extent they always do, and there's a trickle-down effect from finance to the people who provide the services and goods that finance buys. Of course, we know that finance is, on the one hand, very powerful, and on the other hand, very volatile. And so for this year, we have something to worry about from the finance sector.
Why is that?
Well, we've got a very shaky stock market. I'm not making a prediction of a recession in 2007, but everyone expects that job growth and will be slower in the city and in the nation in 2007 than in 2006.
It seems that the city's economy has gotten more and more dependent on Wall Street. Is that do the statistics bear out that perception?
Well, I think they do. I mean, as a share of employment, that's one thing, but as a share of the wages earned in the city, Wall Street is enormous. And there's a big secondary effect of that, which is the share of the income generated by Wall Street that is revenue to the city and the state. So when Wall Street tanks, we get a fiscal crisis, and then we get layoffs in the public sector, and we get huge stress on the public services that people need when there's a recession. So it's a horrible kind of Rube Goldberg chain of events here.
And let's get back to the unemployment rate. The headline number 4.9 is a pretty good one, certainly good by New York City standards, but compares pretty well with the national average. But what about under the average? Are the demographic details quite so happy?
Well, they're not. And I think if there's sort of one overall message in our report this year is that the rising tide has yet to lift the boat of youth employment. So if we look at the unemployment rate for the youngest group of workers, teenagers, there has been no improvement at all since the depths of the recession in their unemployment rate. The unemployment rate for that group was over 28% in 2003, and it's over 28% in 2006. That's almost 10 percentage points higher than it was in 2000. If we look at the fraction of people who are employed in the younger age group, now I'm talking about people 16 through 24, there has been virtually no gain in employment in that cohort after a very sharp drop during the recession. So in 2000, we had roughly 47% of that age group employed. In 2003, it was 35%. In 2006, it was only 36%.
Now, that does, to some extent, mirror national trends. Older workers have been doing better than younger ones. With the national trend, a lot of Wall Street types are saying, oh, these people are all in school, improving their job prospects. Does that look like what's happening here?
Well, to a certain extent, but not to great enough extent. If you look at youth who are not in school, you'll see that the decline in job holding for that group is really what's driven the decline in job holding for youth as a whole. So just looking at out-of-school youth for New York City, we had a decline from 2000 of 64% to 2006 of 56%. And so that's a pretty sharp drop. And we're talking about youth now who are not in school. And that's what's driving the numbers for youth generally.
And what about other demographic groups? Say, how do men and women compare?
Well, when we look at the gender breakdown, we see a pretty similar picture overall. When we look at groups within the genders, we see, you know, a continuing issue of job holding by African-American males. Their job holding rate in 2006 was just over 60% compared to 71% for Hispanics and 78% for non-Hispanic whites.
Yeah, the unemployment rate is based on a pretty strict definition. You have to be actively looking for work. If you're not, you're not counted as unemployed. So you alluded to this by talking about employment rates. What was the story of the share of the New York City population that's actually employed? How does that compare with the national average?
Well, these things, in general, the New York City rate for any group is lower than the national rate. So looking at all New Yorkers 16 and older, the employment rate in 2006 for that group was 56%. For the U.S. as a whole, it was 63%. So that's a pretty big difference.
You mentioned also that some of the low-wage sectors have been leading the way. That's also true nationally. We've seen tremendous growth in the bar and restaurant industries, for example, in national employment stats. Has that been happening here as well?
Right. So leisure and hospitality is a group that has grown by over 28,000 jobs in the last 6 years. Education and health services, which is a low-wage group, although there are some high-wage workers in it, have grown by nearly 80,000 in the last 6 years. So much of the job growth in the city is in these low-wage service industries.
And then, of course, there's the very high-wage Wall Street side. Not much in the middle, then?
Well, it's the middle that's getting hollowed out. So when we look at manufacturing or transportation and utilities, industries that used to provide living wage jobs for people without a four-year college degree, those industries are shrinking as a share of New York City employment.
Where are they going? Are they moving elsewhere or what?
Well, some of them are moving elsewhere. Some of them are just no longer that important to the national economy.
And what about the broad wage trends? Are people getting raises, even if the low-wage sectors are doing well? Are people actually getting raises in those jobs?
Well, we've only seen some wage increases in the last year. So when we look from 2001, when the wages in New York City sort of hit their cyclical peak, to 2006, we still see that workers at the low and middle rungs of the wage distribution, their wages are down by 3% from where they were in 2001. Workers higher up the wage ladder have enjoyed some wage gains. But the wage gains have come late in New York as they have in nationally. We went from a jobless recession to a wageless recession, and finally in 2006, some gains in wages.
I'm speaking with Mark Levitan of the Community Service Society. Yeah, historically, an unemployment rate below 5% suggests a reasonably tight labor market, which should lead to rising wages. But that doesn't seem to be kicking in this cycle. What happened?
Well, I think it's kicked in, but very, very late. So I wouldn't say it hasn't kicked in at all. But I think that one thing, you know, that we always need to keep in mind is that, you know, the unemployment rate is an imperfect measure of slack in the labor market. And so it may be that over time it's becoming actually worse and worse as an indicator of slack, and that as more and more of people who are not holding a job tend to give up looking for work at all, then they drop out of the labor market, and a measure is missing more and more of the potential labor force.
Did the fact that all these people are out of the labor force have any effect on wage setting, or are they just completely out of the picture?
In terms of the official data, they're out of the picture. You know, what they're doing off the books is something that we don't really have a good handle on. You know, I think it's becoming a greater factor, but it's a puzzle exactly how important it is.
Now, speaking of puzzles, you know, you walk around the city and you see gentrification happening everywhere. I just read some British investor bought up 100 units in East Harlem with the anticipation of gentrifying those.
Mm-hmm.
Who is filling these units? Where is the money coming from to finance this gentrification? Or are some of these investors going to be left with a lot of empty inventory?
Well, if the housing market does pop in the way that some people fear, some people are going to take a bath for a couple of years, for sure. But I think that, you know, there's always a tendency for speculative hot money to be running around the globe. And, it's not just the American economy that's kind of in a queasy state at the moment. And in the long run, the U.S. economy is a safe haven for capital. And New York, in the long run, is a fairly successful urban area by American standards. So I don't think that investing in New York City real estate in the long run is such a dumb idea.
But as long as the people who are filling a lot of these don't really live here. the richest man in Kazakhstan has a pied-à-terre in the Time Warner Center, so maybe we've got lots of those kinds of folks running around. But what about this economic model? I mean, we have some neighborhoods of the city are classic depressed urban America, like Detroit or Camden or mm-hmm. North Philly. And yet, on the other hand, we have these tremendous glittery hotbeds of extreme wealth. How does the city compare to other cities in the United States? Is there anything like this, or are we kind of our own unique economy?
Well, I think in some ways we're unique. I mean, we have a poverty rate that puts us in the camp of many older cities in the northeast of the United States, which is very, very high. At the same time, we've got an economy that, you know, in some respects works a lot better than places like Detroit or Cleveland or Philadelphia or, you know, East St. Louis, Newark. We could go on and make a list of real basket cases economically. You know, what's unique about New York, it's not just New York, but but New York is probably the best example, is that we can have, you know, one thing layered on top of the other, that what's going on in Bedford-Stuyvesant or East New York seems not at all to trip up what's happening on Wall Street.
What about the broad poverty trends? Has poverty come down with the unemployment rate?
Well, the poverty rate lags other economic indicators, and the last year for which we have poverty data is 2005. So the poverty rate in the city has stabilized, I think, at about 23%, which is a bit higher than it was at the peak of the business cycle a few years ago. My hunch is that for 2006, we'll probably see a modest decline in the poverty rate. But we're still in a world in which we can safely say that at least, you know, one out of five New Yorkers is living below the federal poverty line, which is an abysmally low standard of living.
Yeah, and this uses national averages, so that it takes no account for the fact that the cost of living is much more expensive here. So we can say that, maybe a quarter to a third of the city's population, by a more reasonable measure, is poor.
I think that's a fair statement.
And it doesn't show really any serious signs of coming down. This is really kind of a structural minimum.
I think that's right. You know, I think that, you know, like I said before, there's this population that is just left out, not included in the broad prosperity that's being generated by other parts of the economy. There's no trickle down for those neighborhoods.
And then what about the broad distribution of income in the city? How does it compare to the rest of the country?
Well, it's much more unequal. I don't have the numbers in front of me, so I can't run them down for you. But New York is a capital of income inequality, and I think the data shows that over time, income inequality is getting worse in the city as opposed to getting better.
So is there anything that we can do about it? Are we in the grip of trends much larger than anything the city can do about it? Or is there things that local and state government can actually do?
Well, I do think that, you know, in the long run, you know, the solutions are at a national level. But certainly there's much more that can be done locally. When we're talking about employment in particular and youth employment, which I think is a special problem here in New York City, this is an area where local policymakers can make a difference. And there's some obvious things we can begin with, and one of them is the abysmally high dropout rate from the New York City public school system. As long as so many of our young people aren't completing high school, or if they are completing it without really having mastered some basic skills, their future in the labor market is going to be very, very bleak. And the city is trying to do more about it. The city, I think, is going to get more resources to do more about it. And this has got to be, you know, very high on the agenda for the rest of this administration and the next administration. The other thing is that I think we need to recognize that the education system is not going to be turned around all that quickly, even if they did everything right. And we also need what I would call a second chance system for young people. And I think the core of that second chance system should be employment-based. We should be creating employment subsidies for young people so that they can get a foot into the labor market.
The city budget's in pretty good shape, at least for now, so there's some money to do these things.
There's a lot of money to do these things. There's almost a $4 billion budget surplus for this fiscal year. And if we just took, you know, like 2.5% of that, you know, we'd have, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars to, you know, put into some kind of, you know, workforce development trust fund that we could draw down on to, you know, to fund some of these programs. I mean, we understand the role of public investment in infrastructure and in the workings of modern economy. We should make a provision for the part of our infrastructure which is human capital, which is the skills of the local workforce.
I don't hear too many politicians talking about this sort of thing. Am I missing something?
No, unfortunately, you're not.
Okay, that's a good, if depressing, note to end on. Thanks, Mark.
You're quite welcome.
And that was Mark Levitan, senior policy analyst at the Community Service Society and author of a report on the New York City job market in 2006, which you can download from their website at cssny.org. cssny.org. Let's take a break for station ID.
Hi, this is Iggy Pop, and you're listening to WBAI in New York, the voice of truth.
I took a pounding from the radio today. I heard the radio say...
We're back. This is WBAI 99.5 on your FM dial and also on the web at WBAI.org. My name is Doug Henwood. The show is Behind the News. And speaking of Iggy Pop, let's take a musical break before we hear from Dean Baker.
Thank you.
and that was the Stooges, led by what the New York Times might call Mr. Iggy Pop, in their 1970 song, TVI. Apropos of not much, except that Iggy is one of the coolest people who ever existed. From roughly 1996 through 2006, the U.S. housing market experienced the most extraordinary boom in its history, extraordinary both for its length and the magnitude of price increases. It now looks to be consolidating, if you're an optimist, or falling apart, if you're a pessimist, or maybe somewhere in between. In any case, the weakening of the housing market is the dominant force in the U.S. economy today. Dean Baker is the co-director of the Center for Economic Policy and Research in Washington, D.C. In the late 1990s, he was one of the most prominent skeptics in the stock market. He turned out to be dead on. And in recent years, he's been one of the most prominent skeptics in the housing bubble. Looks like he was right about that one, too. I apologize for the annoying hum in this interview. It was the fault of a bum phone jack. Never again, I promise. Okay, here's Dean Baker. Welcome, Dean. It wasn't all that long ago that people on Wall Street were saying that the worst of the housing problem was behind us. It doesn't look that way anymore. What's your evaluation of things?
Well, you know, this is a very similar story. If you go back to 2000, as you had the 2000, the first fall in the NASDAQ, and, you know, they said, well, that's the worst of it. And, of course, it kept going down. They're always going to put the most positive spin, but the basic story is that we have a huge overvaluation in housing prices that's been across the country, not everywhere equally, but, you know, certainly a lot of areas we've had very large bubbles. We've seen the beginnings of the deflation hitting first and foremost, or I should say hardest in the subprime market. But this is just the beginning. The basic story is that there's a huge overhang of supply. Our inventories are about 20-25% higher than they were at the same time last year. We know there's a lot of tightening on the demand side because of the mortgage market. A lot of people who could buy homes in 06 aren't going to be able to buy them in 07. And then on top of that, you're going to have a lot of desperation sellers because of these foreclosures. We have a record high vacancy rate on ownership units. So it's very hard to see a story in which prices don't continue to drop, and in many areas, probably by quite a lot.
Let's go back a few years. How did this all get started? Is there a way to date it, or was it more gradual than that?
The basic story in house prices, if you look over the post-war period, is they pretty much track the overall rate of inflation. And Robert Shiller, the finance economist at Yale, probably the preeminent finance economist in the country, has produced data going back to the 19th century that's showing over a 100-year period, house prices have just tracked inflation. That breaks down in the late 90s when you start to get house prices.
Before we go on, let's clarify this. A lot of people think that housing is a sure bet.
Well, absolutely. I mean, people basically say sort of nonsense about housing, just as they do about the stock market. House prices do fluctuate, and, you know, over a long-term trend, that's why I'm making a point of saying, you know, I've looked back over 40 years of government data. Shiller's used some private data going back to the 1890s and finds that, you know, over this very long period, house prices just track the rate of inflation. Then you get this big run-up beginning in the late 90s, which coincides with the stock bubble, and I think that's, you know, the basic story there. That just is what you had in Japan, where you had a real estate and stock bubble going side by side. You had the same sort of story in the U.S., and it's easy to tell the dynamics here. Someone makes a lot of money in the stock market. They want to get a bigger, better home, a second home, whatever it might be, and at least in the short term, you can't build a lot more houses. It's not like cars. So in the short term, that leads to pressure on prices, higher prices. And then the problem is that you begin to see that feeding on itself. People see prices rising. They begin to expect prices rising. And the interesting story in the United States, the contrast with Japan, both bubbles collapsed pretty much at the same time at the end of the 80s. In the United States, we had the stock bubble collapsing in 2000, 2001, 2002. We had people then shift into housing, thinking that that was a safe alternative, and they got support from that from the Fed, both lowering interest rates and also Greenspan acting in sort of a one-man cheerleading squad for the housing market. And what we had was a huge run-up in house prices that continued through 2005 into 2006 when it finally began to turn. So I think it's, you know, fairly easy to put some dates on it. You know, we'll know more, obviously, when we can look back and have it all behind us. But, you know, basically it begins around 95, 96 when the stock market really starts rising at an extraordinary rate. And, you know, the peaks certainly look at this point like 2006 was the peak year.
We've had housing run-ups in the past, the late 70s, late 80s. Is there anything like the recent boom in our history?
No, this really dwarfs anything we've seen. I mean, I'm sure there are local markets where you could find comparable run-ups, and, you know, I often debate David Lira from the National Realtors Association. You know, he jumps up and down yelling that all housing markets are local, and that's fine, but the point is that we had a lot of local markets now that have had extraordinary run-ups in prices, so adjusting for inflation, we've seen an increase in prices on the order of 50%, in fact, a little bit more since the mid-90s. We never had anything like that. And, you know, in the areas where you've had very large run-ups, you know, Florida, parts of California, certainly some of the areas along the East Coast, it's been close to 100% in real terms. So these are really extraordinary run-ups. And again, you'll find a market here or there where you had that, but you didn't have so many markets at the same time that it could move a national index, has been the case over the last decade.
You mentioned Greenspan, and so it's fun to kick him around, so let's do it a little more. Didn't he once say that housing prices never go down, so there's nothing really to worry about?
Well, it wouldn't surprise me if he said that. I don't recall that particular comment. I mean, I actually first started looking at the housing market very closely in the summer of 2002 after Greenspan gave testimony where he was assuring everyone that there was no housing bubble. And the reason why I began to look at it closely was everything he said didn't make any sense. You know, he was saying house prices are rising, but that's explained by the fact that we've had good income growth. And you go, well, income growth hasn't been that good. He said population growth, and, you know, I'm old enough to remember the Social Security debates that population isn't growing. You know, so our population growth actually was not particularly rapid during this period. And then he started saying how we've had limited supply of land and environmental restrictions on building. And, you know, you sort of go, well, the late 90s were not exactly the heyday of the environmental movement with the Republican takeover of Congress and many state legislatures. So Greenspan was very anxious to dispel any idea that there might be a housing bubble and dismiss those people like myself who were out there warning about it. So, you know, he really, you know, deserves blame, credit, however you want to put it. He really was the cheerleader in chief for this run up in house prices.
This is extremely unusual behavior for a central banker, no?
Absolutely. You know, he's often when asked to intervene on issues, you know, like those of us who thought he should intervene the other way, he said, well, the Fed really can't deal with financial bubbles. I would argue that's one of their main responsibilities. But in this case, as I say, he was out there refuting those who were trying to say there was a housing bubble. And one of the things he did in the middle of this, back at the beginning of 2004, when we were already getting into a lot of these crazy exotic mortgages, he got out there and encouraged people. He said it's a good idea for people to get adjustable rate mortgages in many circumstances now.
And that's when we were near a generation low in interest rates, right?
Absolutely. I mean, I was just, when he said that, I almost couldn't believe it. It was, you know, here it was, we had, at the very low, the 30-year fixed rate was down to 5.25. At the point he said that, I think it was probably around 5.3 or 5.4. That was the lowest it had been since the earlier mid-50s. And saying that that was a good time for people to get adjustable rates. Now, that's not exactly what he said. I'll try and be as fair as I can to him. But nonetheless, that was how it was interpreted. And certainly, you know, Alan Greenspan reads the newspapers. So what matters, you know, in a certain sense, it doesn't matter at all what he says. It matters how it's interpreted. And he saw how it was being interpreted as a green light. Go ahead, get adjustable rates, get these exotic mortgages. Everything is fine. At exactly the time where the Fed really should have been trying to clamp down on this, saying, no, this is not sustainable. People are getting in over their heads. They're going to get in big trouble. He was going exactly the wrong way.
What was the contribution of the housing boom to the overall economy? What's its contribution to growth over the last 5 years?
Housing market has been absolutely huge. I mean, if you go back and see what was going on at the time, you know, the recession, the official dating on the recession was March of 2001 to November 2001. After that, supposedly we're in recovery. But if you see what's happening, we continue to lose jobs through 2002, and 2003 basically stabilizes. No jobs, we stop losing jobs, but we aren't creating any. And it's not really until 2004 that the economy actually starts to create any jobs. So at that point, the economy is pretty much dead in the water. And the one thing that, you know, you could really seize upon that was going strongly was the housing sector. So by itself, housing accounts for about 6% of GDP. But even more importantly, at least in this recovery, has been the fact that people have been borrowing against their homes at an incredible rate. And that borrowing has fueled a real surge in consumption over the last 5 years. And, you know, if you look at our savings data, the savings rate has actually been negative for the last 2 years. That's the first time the savings rate has been negative. People are spending more than their income. The first time that's been true since the very beginning of the Depression, 1931 and 1932. So housing has been absolutely central in the economy's recovery since the last recession. And, you know, what I'm inclined to think is you had a situation that, you know, Greenspan didn't have any easy answers in the wake of the stock crash, that a typical recession, if you go back to the recession we had at the end of the 60s, the 70s, you know, in the 80s, the 81, 82 recession, typical story is the Fed raises interest rates, that stops people from buying homes, stops people from buying cars, and then, you know, they realize they've gone too far, they lower interest rates, and you've had this big pent-up demand because no one's bought a home for 2 years, no one's bought a car for 2 years, so now interest rates come back down, and that's, you know, just like setting the economy on fire. You suddenly have all these people rush out and buy a home and buy a new car, and that sparks the recovery. That wasn't an option in 2001, 2002, because we hadn't had that sort of recession. The recession in 2001 was caused by the stock crash, so there was no easy kindling to get the economy going again. So the one thing that Greenspan could seize on was the housing bubble, and he decided to play that to the hilt because, you know, he didn't see anything else out there, and, you know, I guess he was figuring that he'd be gone before he had to deal with the crash of that bubble, and it looks like he was right.
I'm speaking with Dean Baker, co-director of the Center for Economic Policy and Research in Washington, D.C., and a longtime naysayer on the housing bubble. Dean, you mentioned something interesting. We haven't really had a recession in consumer spending in, what, 15 years? Demand for autos, appliances, and, of course, housing has stayed strong since the early 90s, with barely a dip during the 2001 recession. What does this say about the prospects for the household sector in the coming years?
You have a situation where, you know, it's, one, we are likely to see a serious fall-off with the end of the housing bubble because people will suddenly realize they don't have the money that they were counting on. So, you know, as sort of an individual level, well, individual level meaning, you know, millions or tens of millions of individuals suddenly find themselves that they're much, much poorer than they had realized. But the other part of the story is that it's going to be extremely hard to recover from, you know, from this downturn. Because, again, the story with the past downturns was, you know, you stop people from spending for a period of time, there's this big pent-up demand, and then they could just start again. That's not going to be the story here. People are going to realize that they hugely overspent in the sense that, you know, they don't have the savings that they were anticipating. And, you know, looking at the overall demographics, this is, you know, a really big issue for, you know, those of us who care about retirement income. You have a lot of the baby boom cohort right at the edge of retirement in many cases. And you're going to have a lot of people who thought they had $200,000 in equity in their home and suddenly find out that most of that's not there. They're suddenly looking at a very bad retirement. So that's likely to mean they feel that they have to save like crazy. And, of course, a lot of people are going to end up working considerably later in their lives than they thought would be necessary.
Troubles in the subprime sector have recently come to the fore. First, could you give us a primer on what this is all about? And second, do you think it's going to stay confined to that sector, or will it spread?
Well, subprime is, these are people that have mixed credit histories. People who don't qualify for normal mortgages, so they're typically lower, moderate-income people, people who don't have solid employment records. They might have had some problems with credit in the past, bankruptcies, or didn't pay back loans, whatever it might be. So they're not in the prime credit category. And typically that had been a relatively small segment of the housing market because, you know, basically banks didn't want to lend them money. What happened over the last decade is this segment of the market just exploded. So instead of there being a problem that you had a lot of, you know, in fact, you know, people who were trustworthy and would repay their loans not being able to get mortgages, basically banks were throwing money at them. So this sector of the market expanded to 25% of the housing market by 2005. And in many cases, perhaps most cases, these people were not taking out traditional fixed rate, you know, 30-year mortgages, you know, where you could lock in an interest rate. Instead, they were taking out, the overwhelming majority were taking out some sort of adjustable rate mortgage, often with, you know, a period where you locked in a lower rate, a teaser rate, which was well below the market rate for 2 or 3 years, and then it would reset to a much, much higher rate. And this is the core of the problem that we're facing now, that a lot of these people took out mortgages 2002, 2003, 2004 at very low teaser rates, and they could perhaps afford the interest rate on the teaser, you know, the monthly payment at the teaser rate. But those loans are now resetting, often 3 or 4 percentage points higher, and there's no way they could afford those higher rates. And compounding that, as long as house prices were rising, you know, none of this really matters because that covers all sins. If the house prices are rising, they could always borrow against the equity or they sell their home. You know, they just get out and they've made some money, you know, nothing to worry about. But now that house prices are falling, they've been falling since last year, you have a lot of people that have little or no equity in their house. They can't afford the mortgage payment, and that's leading to record levels, or I shouldn't say yet, but very rapidly rising default rates in that subprime sector. I'm sure we'll be at record levels very shortly. Now, the question is, will that just be confined to the subprime sector? And the conventional wisdom is, oh, it'll just be, you know, just this, you know, poor, you know, the low, moderate income people, that's all that's going to be affected. That doesn't make any sense. You know, it's 25% of the housing market. There's also an intermediate grade. It's called the Alt-A market. These are people with somewhat better credit histories, but for a variety of reasons, they aren't able to get prime mortgages. That's about 15% of the market. That's facing similar problems. So you have a severe tightening of credit in 40% of the mortgage market. There's no way on earth that can't affect the whole market, because even if, you know, I'm, let's say I have an upper income home and, you know, a person I'm looking to sell it to has a good credit history, they'll get a prime mortgage, there's a decent chance that they might be looking to sell their home to someone who's in that subprime or Alt-A market. It's a whole chain, and if they can't sell their home or they have to sell it for a much lower price, what they can afford to pay me will be considerably less. So you can't have a serious credit tightening in 40% of the housing market and not think it affects the whole market. This is a market-wide story. Now, the timing may vary, but it's certainly going to affect the whole market.
You have to wonder what the lenders were thinking when they were writing all these mortgages. In the old days, banks would keep mortgages in their books for the full 30-year term. Now they package them into bonds and sell them to the financial markets, which until recently had a ravenous appetite for the things. Is that the problem, securitization? Or was it part of the psychology of the bubble, when people think nothing could ever go wrong? What were they thinking when they lent all this money to people who really shouldn't have gotten it?
Well, I think securitization really is front and center. So, you know, so just the basic story, as you were saying, you know, back 20, 30 years ago, a bank issued a loan and they were going to sit on it. You know, you had a 30-year mortgage, they expected you to be paying that mortgage for 30 years, or, you know, you'd sell the house and then they'd get their money back then. So they were very concerned, you know, what would happen, you know, in subsequent years, that you were the sort of person to be able to pay off that mortgage. Securitization, though, what that means is that, you know, as soon as they issue the mortgage, and quite literally I often mean as soon, you know, they're looking to dump the mortgage the very next day into a mortgage pool, and, you know, their expectation is that they're never going to see it again. They're making money on issuing the mortgage. They basically don't care what happens, you know, next year, 5 years from now, or even next month. So there's a very strong incentive for them simply to issue the mortgage, whether or not the person at the other end is going to be able to pay off the mortgage. And part of this story, there's just there were some press reports in the business press yesterday about Beazer Homes, one of the major builders, that there was a big element, or I should say they're investigating them for fraud. And the logic, the fraud in this story, Beazer, like many of the builders, has their own financing arm. So the logic of the story here is that their financing arm would issue mortgages perhaps with false information, perhaps exaggerating the assessment of the home. There's a lot of things you could put down that would allow a mortgage to go through that really shouldn't. And they're willing to do that because they know that they could dump the mortgage in the secondary market right away. And, of course, Beazer has a special incentive to do that because they want to sell the home. So, you know, both are going to make money on the mortgage, but more importantly, you know, from the standpoint of the builder, this is the way they dump their homes.
Who's going to take the hit on this bubble's bursting?
Well, obviously, you're going to have a lot of people, homeowners, you know, who are going to find that, you know, their home's not worth what they thought it was. A lot of people are going to find they can't afford to stay in their home. You know, one of the things that it's just infuriating to me that there was a real push, you know, certainly by a lot of political figures, but also some people in the nonprofit community thought it was a great way for, you know, low, moderate income people to build wealth, to be homeowners. Now, I don't have anything against being a homeowner. I'm not one now, but I have been at other points in my life. I don't say it's a bad thing, but it's not always a good thing, and it's certainly not a clever thing to do when you have a bubble, as we had the last few years, and you take out a loan that you really can't afford to pay back. So you have a lot of low, moderate income people that, you know, obviously worked very hard to try and get into a home, and now they're going to find they lose it and may never have another opportunity. That's certainly not good news for them. Now, the other really big losers, and we'll have to see how this shakes out, are the people who are holding those bad mortgages. You have, you know, those mortgages got packaged into pools, and, you know, those are bought up in the secondary market. And, you know, who holds them, you know, is anyone's guess. They're widely dispersed. I'm sure the holdings are more concentrated some places than others. I'm sure we're going to find a lot of these hedge funds were big into these mortgages. The basic story was that, you know, the pools were very, very risky, and the people buying the mortgages, the securities based on these mortgages, should have recognized the risk, but they obviously didn't because they weren't carrying the sorts of premiums. I mean, what you would have expected is there'd been a huge premium associated with those mortgage pools based on the risk involved, and for the most part, they actually got very small premiums. So who holds those, you know, we'll find out probably, you know, another 6 months or a year down the road, in a really bad scenario, and I don't think this is at all impossible, you could actually see this hit a lot of the banks that are, you know, they are backing up a lot of these mortgage-backed securities. In the extreme case, you know, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, you know, if we get a big enough hit to the housing market, which, again, I think is absolutely plausible, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac themselves could, you know, could have their survival called into question. Again, I wouldn't necessarily bet on that. I'm just saying that, you know, in an extreme case where you get widespread defaults, I certainly wouldn't rule it out.
And the finest minds on Wall Street were devising securities that hid the potential risks for investors. How long do you think this is going to take to play out, and how bad is it likely to get?
I think it's easier to say how low it will go than how long it will take. You know, it says a similar thing about the downturn in the stock market in 2000, that, you know, it's easier to say, you know, sort of roughly what would be, you know, normal price-to-earnings ratios rather than it would be to say how long it'll take us to get there. Because that really is driven by psychology. Just as the upswing was driven by psychology, so will be the downswing. And if we get, you know, serious, you know, fear, serious flight from you know, mortgage finance, so that, you know, the financing of not just subprime and Alt-A, but even prime loans really tightens up and the interest rates on those loans rise a lot, well, then, you know, then we will see the adjustment take place much more quickly. But, you know, I'm just kind of shooting in the dark. I think we'll probably have seen most of the adjustment in the next year or so. But, you know, it could, you know, the Fed obviously wants to drag this out. Bernanke's trying his best to say, oh, it's not a big deal.
You think he really believes that, or is he just trying to reassure?
What I guess I would say is I think he would say that whether he believed it or not. So I'd never met him personally. I guess I've heard him speak, and maybe we talked a moment or two after the session. But I don't know, you know, Ben Bernanke at all, so I don't really won't claim any insight to what he actually believes. But I think it's probably fair to say he would say that whether he believes it or not.
And that was Dean Baker, co-director of the Center for Economic Policy and Research in Washington. You can read his work on housing and other matters, and that of his esteemed colleagues as well, at their website, cepr.net, cepr.net. Actually, Greenspan did say something very much like that house prices never decline. In May 2004, he said, "A destabilizing contraction in nationwide house prices does not seem the most probable outcome. Indeed, nominal house prices in the aggregate have rarely fallen, and certainly not by very much." And by nominal, of course, he meant not adjusted for inflation. And then later, in March 2005, he said something very similar. "A destabilizing contraction in nationwide house prices does not seem the most probable outcome. To be sure, the recent marked increase in the investor share of home purchases suggests rising speculation in homes. However, nominal house prices in the aggregate have rarely fallen, and certainly not by very much. And even should more than average price weakness occur, the increase in home equity as a consequence of the recent sharp rise in prices should buffer the vast majority of homeowners." He said very similar things about the stock market in the late 1990s. So, Greenspan, who started his career several decades ago as a not very good economic forecaster, ended it with some pretty bad forecasts as well. Okay, that's it for me, Doug Henwood. Stay tuned for the news and on into the evening. Let's go out with this from the Scissor Sisters, "She's My Man." Till next week, bye.